Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're in our New York City studios, video streaming also over Facebook. And I want to thank the thousands of people who have come and most listen on the download at night. But we had, watching the program and listening live 2 weeks ago, almost 15,000 new people in just 1 half hour. So we thank them and then sharing the information with others. Today, in fact, I'm going to be addressing many of your questions on Facebook and giving you some answers to what is important to you. Also, today we're going to have a lot of good health and nutrition information, as we do each day. And then about halfway through the program, we'll have a music break. And then those who only want health and nutrition and environmental information, that's it. And then we'll go on and deal with some other issues. Now, what are those other issues? I'm going to give you something rather radical. I'm going to say why we should not be voting for Jill Stein or any Green Party candidate in the next election. Not because they're not qualified, and not because they're not on the right side of issues. They are. But I'm going to share a completely radical idea with you. I haven't heard anyone else share this, but it's a beginning. It's a starting point where we can begin to have dialogue for a new America and resolve a lot of our issues. Also today, we'll be taking a look at the next part in that ongoing series of what's wrong with the medications we're taking, especially the statin drugs. And also, if you're told you don't have any heart disease, you don't have high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, and yet you're encouraged to take a very toxic drug, why? That would be like saying, I don't have cancer, but maybe I had to take chemotherapy, adriamycin, or one of the other very popular chemotherapies. Why? If you say that enough times, and if you have credible people that people are likely to trust, many people actually do that. Just like think of all the tens of thousands of women who've had radical mastectomies, completely removing non-cancerous breasts, like Angelina Jolie. Not because there was cancer, but because there was this gene that is not highly accurate in predicting future cancer, as if even the gene were legitimate 100% of the times. We know that lifestyle intervention could change the gene's expression. So why do we get to where we're not listening to any realistic alternative ideas? I'm going to deal with that today. Also, I'm going to share an idea of how we can improve the lives of young children in our educational system. They're just ideas. I know many of you have good ideas, many teachers and counselors, sociologists, and people who see the consequences of our existing multi-tiered educational system. We shouldn't have multi-tiers, but we do, and there's a consequence to it. I'm going to explain that. We're also going to be showing you some audio clips in addition to what I just mentioned, including, I'm going to share in the second part of our program, information that Hillary Clinton, while she was Secretary of State, knowingly conspired with Saudi Arabia and Qatar to fund and weaponize ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups. And this is not a conspiracy theory. As you will see, we have the actual WikiLeaks, that was not focused upon in the last investigation. We found it, and we're going to read it to you. And this is from her top outside advisor. So when her advisor is telling her, yeah, we know who are supplying, protecting, and funding the terrorists, why isn't the mainstream media talking about that? If nothing else, then the contradiction. Do we want to fight terrorists, or do we want to fund and support terrorists? So if we're funding and supporting terrorists, and we say we're fighting them, That's just not a contradiction in logic and reason. It's a massive lie. Why aren't people talking about this? They should be. We will. So we're going to review this Hillary Clinton email, because remember, Hillary Clinton hasn't gone away, nor have the corporate Democrats who need her or a corporate Democrat in power in order to continue benefiting from that. Let's begin. First up, I want to go into questions that were raised, and I'll read the person's name and then offer in the question. And this is from Facebook. And the first person was asking about, let's see, cinnamon. Gary, are all cinnamons the same? This is from Sharon. Could you talk a little bit more about different types of cinnamon in some future video? Well, I'm happy to, Sharon. Why? Because I believe that cinnamon is an extremely important condiment to use. What does it do, first off? Well, it depends upon the cinnamon you get. But cinnamon can naturally thin your blood, meaning it helps keep the red blood cells from aggregating, especially if you've had fat in a meal. Here's how it works. Let's say that you had a healthy lunch. The blood cells will stay spaced. But let's say you have cheese or milk or meat. The fat will allow streaks of fat in the bloodstream. Those act almost like an adhesive to blood cells. They begin to clump, and that clumping can cause a clot, and that could block your heart or block your brain, in which case you have either a stroke in the brain or a heart attack. So cinnamon helps reduce unwanted blood platelet clotting, and that results in a better blood flow. It's just healthier. It also reduces the arachidonic acid, which is an inflammatory fatty acid, and it removes blood impurities, so you have healthier, better, and thinner blood, and that's what you want. It's also very, very good antimicrobial. It's been specific in its antiviral, antimicrobial, antiparasitic action, and that's why throughout history it's been used as a preservative. You'll see a lot of cinnamon used in Indian food, Southeast Asian food, where they may not have all the elements we have to sanitize food or to sanitize the dishes or even our hands. So they use specific spices that can help kill bacteria and that. That's good. It also is good for diabetes. It can help lower blood sugar. It can lower the bad part, the LDL fraction of cholesterol, and the triglycerides. Because when both of those are elevated, you won't feel it, you won't know it, unless you've had a blood chemistry test, but that makes you more susceptible to a heart attack or stroke and cancer. New studies show that it's good for the brain. Cinnamon removes nervous tension and memory loss. It improves cognitive function, attention span, virtual recognition memory, working memory, and visual motor response. And therefore, I always recommend in my protocols, anyone suffering from memory loss, which starts in your 40s and advances from there, to full-blown Alzheimer's, that you take about a quarter teaspoon of cinnamon per day. Now the question is, what kind of cinnamon? There are a lot of different cinnamons. There's two cinnamons that I would recommend. One is known as Jamaican cinnamon, but number one clearly is Ceylon cinnamon. Ceylon. It's also known as true cinnamon or Mexican cinnamon. Why? Because all cinnamons have some healing capacity, but almost all the others have an ingredient that I don't want in people's body because it's been attached to liver adverse conditions. And that is a particular item called coumarin. C-O-U-M-A-R-I-N. For example, in Ceylon cinnamon, it's 0.0017 per gram, whereas in Indonesian cinnamon that I don't recommend, or Padang cinnamon, which is 2.2, but the worst cinnamon, in my opinion, is Saigon cinnamon or Vietnamese cinnamon, and that's almost seven parts per gram, and that's very high. So I would stay away, and I would stay away from Chinese cinnamon and cassia cinnamon. Again, those are my personal projections on that. So that's the latest on cinnamon. Tells you which cinnamon to get and why you should use it on a daily basis. This is from Kurt Washington. He asks, how can I find Gary's protocols? A little context to your answer, Kurt. There was a time when I saw everyone with any condition you could imagine. And if anyone remembers coming down to the Tri-State Healing Center or at my office over on 84th Street near Riverside Drive in a brownstone, the door would open at 8 in the morning and close at midnight, and it was packed nonstop. Not because I don't charge, I've never charged a nickel for helping people, but because so many people had so many things wrong. And it would disappoint me when I couldn't see someone who was given a death sentence, they were terminal, ill, and yet I'd just spent an hour with someone who simply had constipation. So then I said, I'm going to make sure that the people I'm helping are the people most likely to benefit. So I started helping people who are terminally ill. So that said, I said, I can't help everyone. There's just too darn many people. So what do I do? So then what I decided to do after that was to put it all into books, articles, DVDs. So whatever you needed, I'd have protocols there. So I began to write very definitive books. And when I say definitive, I mean very definitive. Definitive in 1,300-page books, 1,600-page books, huge books. And because I was a best-selling author, my publishers acquiesced. Otherwise, today, they only want like a 200-page book. So it depends upon what you need. If you need anything on women's issues, I have a book that's 1,100 pages, brand new. I haven't even talked about it yet, called The New Healthy Woman. So you name the condition that's in there. And to help people out this week, I'm putting a whole chapter in there, free, all the whole protocol on, let's say, breast cancer and then menopause next week. So each week I'm going to put another thing in, plus a recipe, beautiful recipe, in, to show you how to make gourmet, vegan, tasty, delicious, aesthetically pleasing meals. The Get Healthy Now, I published at least 30 major reference books. I mean, these are big books with protocols, plus all the documentaries I do. And a lot of them you can see up on YouTube for free. You know, reversing and preventing heart disease naturally, cancer, arthritis, diabetes, rebooting your brain, all these. So you name the condition and it's up there. Detoxification, building the immune system naturally. So all you have to do is just a little homework. Just go up and Google Gary Knoll, look under the library, and you'll see over 700 articles. If you want to know about vaccines, I have over 41 articles I've written alone on vaccines up there. So there's no difficulty getting those protocols. Then we have Dottie Wilson. Dottie says she's talking about helping someone in her family, and she said she won't discuss non-traditional cancer treatments with her children. Here's the issue. In order to help someone, they have to want that help. I can't tell you how many times I spent hours sitting with someone who has a very serious illness, and you can see their eyes glaze over. They're there because their husband, wife, son, daughter, someone brought them, and expecting because they're there that the person's going to implement the protocol. Almost never do they. So first things first, have whatever condition the person suffers from, watch a documentary on it. In my case, I have over 100 different topics I handle. So watch it together and then ask the person, okay, we've seen a documentary. We've seen regular orthodox doctors who have tried natural non-toxic therapies and gotten great results. Here's their patient. Here's the person talking. Here's the doctor, board certified, just like your doctor, except your doctor doesn't know about these other therapies. Now, if the person says, I don't care, I'm not going to try that. My doctor says none of this stuff works. I'm going to see chemotherapy, radiation, surgery works. That's it. At some point, you have to understand you must honor the person that you love's choice. Even if you disagree with it, it's their right. And there's nothing worse than not honoring someone's choice, and then you have that conflict, and the conflict can cause incredible disruption in how they're processing that negativity. Let me give an example. Yesterday, I went over to Lincoln Center to see a movie on America's Greatest Ballerina. She was the top ballerina for 30 years. In fact, more original choreography was done for her than any other ballerina in American history. And having a 30-year career as the top ballerina in America is formidable. And it was about how she had injured her hip and was getting it surgery on it. And in effect, she was told by Martins, who runs the whole operation, that it's time for you to bow out. We don't want to see you. We don't want the audience to see you in declining stage of performance. And the whole movie is about how she's grappling with that and then her final performance. But she says something very important in the movie. The documentary done of her, I would give it a C minus. Because as a filmmaker, when I'm watching a film, I'm saying, how would I do that? What is the message you want to convey? Are you telling the story the way it should be? For example, you see her husband in a couple scenes. We know nothing about the husband at all. Her mother, nothing about it. Her friends, nothing. What she does when she's not, you know, mastering the craft of being a ballerina, nothing. We don't know if this woman has a life outside of all the years that she was this ballerina. I want to know more about the person. But here's the most revealing point to the whole film for me. At no point did they say that the inflammation caused by her training, performing, could be turned off with important oils and nutrients. No mention of that at all. And I'm sitting there thinking, and this is what goes on in my mind. I can't tell you how many people from the New York Ballet and the Symphony and conductors and Broadway stars and that who thought they were end of something, and I helped them, it reversed. And it was easy, natural, non-toxic, and inexpensive. So on the one hand, I'm thinking, wow. You would think in an artistic community where there are so many open-minded people, so many progressive thinkers and artists, how did she, being number one, not know this or not even have anyone encourage it? But it wasn't discussed. But then she said she was fine. She never had a problem, never had an ache, never had a pain, never had a fatigue, nothing, until she sat down with Martins, who's the director, and he said, you know, your body isn't the same. You can't perform it the same. That's why we're not putting in all these. And immediately, all of her symptoms manifested. Right then and there is where I would have brought in Herbert Benson from Harvard, the person who brought us the body-mind connection. I would have brought in some experts on psychoneuroimmunology, meaning what you believe, what you hear in a moment can suddenly change your entire anatomy. And we now have tons of scientific studies, over 2,000 studies from the independent peer review literature showing that you can actually change your DNA by your thoughts, positive or negative. Well, if she never had a single problem in her career, and now she is being told it's time for her to retire, and she wasn't ready to retire, and she says, immediately after that, my whole body breaks down. And yet there's not another discussion about that. It was like one of those 30-second comments in a film. Well, think how many people are told you're too old, it's time to get out of the sport. One of my fantasies, one of my dreams, being an athlete, being a world-class athlete, a competitive athlete, and still am, is when I see people who are remarkably gifted in their athleticism and they retire because they're told they're too old or that their body can't keep the pace at that level of performance. And I'm thinking, that's not true. Look at how many people live in their off season. How many are out drinking, doing drugs, eating a terrible diet, gaining weight, losing it, gaining it back? Yeah, they're not going to be able to compete, but what about those that stay in great shape, that know the science of nutritional biochemistry, who can rejuvenate the cells, who can take senescent cells, cells approaching death, and revitalize them. I spent my entire career as research fellow in anti-aging medicine, the Institute of Applied Biology. So when you work for years, for decades, and you can reverse the aging of humans, reverse the aging of rats, rats that would have died, you give them double their lifespan, and you do it over and over again, and you prove all this, and then you do clinical studies, and you prove you can reverse disease. Why should this information not be anywhere in athletic science? The only thing in athletic science is which hormones to take, which proteins to take. Someone's selling you something, and therefore they're going to promote that something, and then it passes around a gym. No one's talking about what really rejuvenates the cell. As long as your cells are rejuvenating, your mitochondria is rejuvenating, your energy factors are rejuvenating, then you still got your energy, you can repair muscle tissue, repair heart tissue. There's no reason that you couldn't add time on. So what I want to do, again, I don't have right now the resources to do this, but maybe someday I will, is to buy a place and turn it into a training campus. Maybe like buy an old Catskill Resorts, where you got a running track and a baseball field and indoor basketball court and a soccer field, and then bring together some retired coaches, but everybody has to follow the same protocol. So first, you take someone who's retired, newly retired and old retired, and during 1 year, they have to stay on campus for 1 year. They can be visited by their family, but every day they're training differently, a whole different type of training. Body-mind training and nutritional biochemistry and reversing their aging process, and film each one of them in their respective fields of athleticism. I'm willing to bet that a year later, showing the person and their body and their performance level when they come in, and a year later, that a lot of those people could go back right into the sport that they had loved, and then send a message to a whole younger generation, we can reverse the whole idea of what it is to be a competitive athlete. Yeah, that's just one of my loves and desires, but won't happen yet. But for non-athletes, it has happened and is happening. So just remember, and by the way, this is from Jamie. And Jamie is from Northern Canada and says two things that you should look into on upcoming programs. China's investment in green towers with lots of trees on them to beautify their cities and to act like mini carbon sinks. And two, I think that the new hydroponic large-scale organic farms in the middle of cities are important. I would agree. Let me address both. I believe that, let's say, if anyone knows Jay-Z and his wife, Beyonce, I read in Variety that they just laid down $120 million to purchase a home in Beverly Hills. Now, that's just the purchase price. Of course, people always want to go in and make over something, so it's in their desired aesthetics. So probably you're looking at about $130 million they're going to spend. So I did some mathematics, and here's what I came up with. With their celebrity presence and the people they know, I'm quite sure that for that $130 million, given to a nonprofit charity, they could go into any one of the ghettos that you can find in boroughs. That's not to say that the borough is a ghetto. It's mean that within the borough, you have areas that are ghettos. And you could have the city turn over empty block buildings and level them all. And on one block, you rebuild a community garden, hydroponics. You can do it 3, 4, 5 stories tall. I come up with new designs so that we don't have to think the old way that a hydroponic has to be, oh, you go over and pick it. Wrong. I'm doing hydroponics right now that are brand new and revolutionary, and where you can get 3 times the amount of produce out of the same space in 20 days, what would normally take 60, 90 days, 20 days. So you could feed tens of thousands of people in that community organic, locally grown produce, fruits, berries, herbs, vegetables, tomatoes, cucumbers, lettuces, every day. And because it's done as a nonprofit, they get it at lower prices than they would if they went to a regular supermarket. Forget a health food store, just a supermarket, even lower in farmers markets. So, A, you're helping improve the nutrition in inner city. Then in the next block attached to this, you build a center, a cultural center, because what do I personally believe is missing in much of the people living in inner city? Deeper culture, meaning have a building where everything in there is about learning to master the arts, music, have violin and cello, all the different instruments taught, ballet. If you notice, if you see this documentary down at Lincoln on 65th Street at the theater there, Walter Reed Theater, that's the one where you walk up the steps, you'll notice that in all the ballet scenes, the audience are all grayhead. There's no young people. Now, there are certainly a lot of young people at Juilliard and other schools around the city, but the audience is old. And a lot of our youth have not been acquainted with the great arts to appreciate them. So if you bring theater, opera, ballets, symphonies, teaching them and performing them, you have a performance hall in the inner cities so that every kid, every parent has a chance to know that, gee whiz, my kid has a chance. And then you have a school there, not a charter school, a school where children are taught how to think deep, more deeply, at a higher level, so that if they choose to go to a state or private university, they will not be in the bottom part of that school. Because here's how it works. Let's say that you go to a school in a poor neighborhood. Now, there will be exceptions, but for most, there won't be a high level of graduation. And if they do, it's simply because they were frequently given advantages to get them out of school. But then they go to college. Let's say that under a grant or some provision, they're able to go to Harvard. More often than not, you'll have the highest dropout rate, the lowest graduation rate from the group that was raised in the inner city. So who's the number one graduating at the top of the class and almost always graduating? Asians. Asians graduate at the highest level with the least dropouts. Why? Maybe they're genetically conditioned? No. They're no different. But their parenting is different. If you go into a Japanese school, for example, you'll frequently find no chefs. The kids are taught how to cook. They cook healthy meals. They don't have janitors. The kids go in and sanitize down the whole room, desks, floors. They mop everything. they clean out the bathrooms. This is all before they go to school. They have recesses. The emphasis is not on homework. It's paying attention in school because they want the child to develop and not be burned out. So it's about the parenting skills and the level of academic insight while they're in schools. And then you have private educated Caucasians coming in second, those whose parents can spend money so their kids get special tutors. Well, I want to tell you, you take any kid from the ghetto and every day you tutor them. And you give them insights, and you show them not just how to take a test, but the meaning of each issue on the test. You're going to have a student that when they graduate, they're going to look forward to going to the next level of education, and they're going to have the intellectual discipline, the curiosity, and the sense of, I can figure this out. I can do this. And they're going to rise right up to the top of that class. So right now, what we're not focused on in America at all is how can we help those students, help the teachers, help the parents in communities that are not receiving the type of assistance they need so those children are not just able to graduate from that school they're in, because you could graduate number one in some inner city school and you'd be dead last at Harvard. I want to see those kids from inner city be number one at Harvard, and they can do it. Absolutely. If we support that effort, if we stop giving all the money to administrators, the schools are over-administered and the schools have become derelict, and then bring a whole new sense of civic pride and cultural pride and educational achievement pride into the school so kids feel good about going to school and it's not a war zone. Now, if you think that that's an over-exaggeration, let me share something from Chris Hedges. I just read this morning. I thought it was relevant. This is called A Pipeline Straight to Jail, Truth Dig, Chris Hedges. The defeat of the Harvard University debate team by a team from the Eastern New York Correctional Facility in the Catskills elucidates the true truth known intimately by those of us who teach in prisons, that the failure of the American educational system to offer opportunities to the poor and the government's abandonment of families and children living in blighted communities condemns millions of boys and girls, often of color, to a life of suffering, misery, and early death. The income inequality, the trillions of dollars we divert to the war industry, the flight of manufacturing jobs overseas, and the refusal to invest in our infrastructure wrecks life after an innocent life. I spent 4 years as a graduate student at Harvard University. Privilege, and especially white privilege, I discovered is the primary prerequisite for attending an Ivy League university. I've also spent several years teaching in prisons. In class, after the class in prison, there's a core of students who could excel at Harvard. This is not hyperbole, as the defeat of the Harvard debate team by the prisoners illustrates. But poverty condemned my students before they even entered school. And as poverty expands, inflicting on communities and families a host of maladies, including crime, addiction, rage, despair, and hopelessness, the few remaining institutions that might intervene to lift the poor up are gutted and are closed. Even when the students in inner-city schools are not the targets of racial insults, racism worms into their lives because the institutions that should help them are non-existent or deeply dysfunctional. I stood outside a prison gate in Newark, New Jersey at 7 a.m. last April 21st. I waited for the release of one of my students, Boris Franklin, who had spent 11 years incarcerated. I had ridden to the gate with his mother, who spent her time reading Bible verses out loud in the car and with her sister. We watched him walk down the road towards us. He was wearing baggy gray sweatpants, oversized white T-shirt, and white Reeboks that prisoners purchased before the release. Franklin, with the broad shoulders and muscular chest and arms that come with years of weightlifting, clutched the manila envelope containing his medical records, instructions for parole, and his birth certificate, his Social Security card, and his ID issued by the Department of Motor Vehicles. And also, he had to leave behind 100 books. They don't allow you to take them out. The first words he spoke to me as a free man after more than a decade in prison was, "I have to rebuild my library." You don't know what to think or feel at that moment. He said to me recently about the moment of his release, "You're just walking. It's almost surreal. You can't believe it. After such a traumatic experience, you are numb. There's no sense of triumph." When Franklin was in prison, he was a student under the New Jersey Scholarship and Transformative Education in Prisons Consortium. Now at 42, he is attending Rutgers University under the University of Mountain View program for ex-offenders. He's seeking a degree in social work and plans to assist the formerly incarcerated. This is an unusual and rare opportunity for a freed prisoner. Franklin, like many others I have taught, should never have ended up in prison. His brilliance, his hunger to learn, his passion for ideas, if nurtured, would have led him to a very different life. But when you're poor in America, everything conspires to make sure you remain poor. The invisible walls of our internal colonies, keeping the poor penned in like livestock, mirror the physical walls of prison that many of these communities are doomed to experience. "I started school in Piscataway, New Jersey," he said. "It was a predominantly white school. There was a lot of space. It was clean. There was order. People walked down the halls and lines. I've been prepared in Head Start." When he was in the second grade, his family moved. He started attending an inner-city school in New Brunswick. The two schools, he said, were night and day. The classrooms in New Brunswick were shabby, dirty, and overcrowded. Many of the children were loud and disruptive. In Piscataway, we were taught how to learn, how to read, how to scan texts for information. But in New Brunswick, it was a zoo. It was mostly Black and Hispanic. There were fights all the time. I doubt the teachers were even qualified. It was not an environment where you could teach anything. Kids would come into school and slam things down and turn stuff over. They were angry. I remember seeing a girl in my class, a victim of child abuse, with welts all over her. She later became a drug addict. Your fight-or-flight mechanisms as a child is activated even before you walk out of the house. Your blood pressure goes up. There are drugs and alcohol all around you. You see fights on the way to school. You see dope addicts slumped over. You see police jump on someone and beat them up. You run into gangs of all kinds. I knew kids who dropped out of school because it was dangerous to be in school. If you had a fight, they would find out what school you went to, and they would be there to retaliate when you got out. We used to take bats and knives to school and put them by the door when we came out in case there was a confrontation. I got my first weapons charge at age 14 for a handgun. You're not in a state to learn anything. Of course, criminals have low brain arousal. They have been desensitized since childhood. This is how you deal with your constant danger. You go numb, and you become a danger to others and yourself. The students in my third grade class were tracing out letters. They were trying to learn how to write. I was writing in cursive. I could multiply and divide. They did not even know how to add and subtract. The two schools were only 20 minutes apart, but in New Brunswick, you were not taught how to think. You were taught rote behavior, to obey. I was told to sit in the back of the class, be quiet, and wait for the other children to catch up. But they never did. There was always drugs in homes. I had friends whose homes were raided when they were children. Most of the parents were getting high, including my father. I did not know any child who did not have a drug addict in the home. And if a person was not a drug addict, he or she often was suffering from some other form of mental illness. It seemed everyone was dealing with something. Those who were left with their grandparents were in the best situation. Kids would say that they were living with their grandparents. They would never mention their mother or father. I never saw the fathers of most of my friends. They had disappeared or were in jail. That's just part of his article. So let's just imagine now we go back to our blocks. And now in that next block, we have every form of rehabilitative therapy. People wanting to get out of gangs and don't have a place to stay and are afraid of retaliation. People want to get off their addictive substances, whatever they may be, but don't want to end up in a hospital and have a record or be arrested. People who are coming from a broken family, and maybe one person in the family, one parent, doesn't know how to be a complete guardian of the child, so comes there because there's support. And then you have a group of people who would be big brothers and big sisters, older people in the community who want to use the time and love and energy they have to encourage another person. Well, that you have. And then so you have a place where people in the community who are having challenges will have a place to go, and there'll be professional people more than enough to help them no matter what their issue. There's a holistic medical clinic there. There's a holistic assisted living center where people go in who would need to be in assisted living because they can't take care of themselves. But after being given holistic therapies and organic food and different types of physiotherapy and chiropractic and homeopathy and chelation therapy and vitamin drips, they're able to go back home because you've gotten their health back. And then there's also an office of legal aid where you can see lawyers who can help you or those that you care about who are up against the system and need help and don't want to plead out, as 95% of all cases do. It makes the state look like they're right about everything, and no, they're not. It's just that the opposition, the accused, don't have the money to fight. Now, then you have a sports arena where you have people from all sports come and encourage athleticism as a way of developing character. And you get the good athletes, of which there are many, who are not just in it for, you know, how much Coke they can afford, how many, you know, vodka bottles they can, you know, pass around a party, and how many people they can have sex with. and how much money they can spend carelessly and end up bankrupt, but good quality, conscientious athletes or just model citizens, and there are many. They don't get the credit, they don't get the attention, but they're there. They would donate time. And a lot of them are retired. So imagine all that. Or you spend $130 million on a home in Beverly Hills, which is what they've done. So you see, there are ways of reallotting our resources if we realize we have enough. And therefore, isn't it a moral imperative, if you have a gift, to give a gift? I believe it is. Now, we're going to go out of this segment with the next part of why the medical community, your doctor, should be challenged in a diplomatic way, not in any accusatory manner, but put the burden of proof on them that anything they're suggesting that you take or ingest or treatment you get is independently scientifically verified to improve the quality of your life instead of possibly costing your life.
In its effect, it's certainly scientific fraud. And in its effect, it's organized crime. It's always difficult to allege intent, but it is clear that manipulation of evidence subjects many people to treatments that those people should never have been subjected to.
I think there is criminal activity that goes on. And I think when drug companies act in ways that misrepresent information that leads to harm, they ought to be held responsible, just like any other individual or organization that conducts itself in a way that leads to harming other people.
Drug companies have a history of illegal activity. This is just a sample of the billions of dollars in fines they incur for things like fraud and bribery in any given year. In the 80s, when President Reagan came into office and slashed funding to the National Institutes of Health, it left a gaping hole for private industry to move in. Nowadays, around 85% of trials are funded by drug companies. A review concluded that if a drug company paid for a trial, it was 24% more likely to report the drug was effective, and 87% less likely to report the drug's side effects.
There is a sense that science is science, so it doesn't matter who pays for it. And yet, because the research is privatized, the fundamental purpose for which it's conducted has changed. It's not to improve the public's health, it's to fulfill the fiduciary obligations of the sponsors and create an opportunity to maximize profits instead of improve the public's health.
Some might say that that's a rather cynical view of how science works.
To say it's cynical that commercial sponsorship of science taints the science is just totally naive. It's silly. Business is in business. Their job is to make money. We ought to be clear in our public discourse that to say we've got a bias in commercially sponsored research is neither cynical nor paranoid nor impolite. It's a fact. So let's just accept it as a fact and stop being naive at our own expense.
But if Big Pharma doesn't pay, it will have to be the taxpayer.
A drug now costs about $2 billion to develop. The success rate of drugs is very low. You know, is the public purse going to be willing to shell out in advance for $2 billion for a drug which it doesn't know the likely outcome of?
Arguably, the biggest ethical issue in science is that drug companies withhold unflattering results. So in the end, what we're presented with is a distortion of the data.
Now, a couple of things there. First off, yes, it does cost up to $2 billion, and he said with very low results. And who would pay for this? Well, why don't we put money into preventing disease in an educational program in every school in America, in every grade in every school in America? That's inexpensive. And teachers and people at all levels of education want that information. We have a lot of teachers listening right now, and they would love to change the curriculums. And so We don't need to think that the only answer to disease is a drug, and therefore we have to rely upon the drug industry, even when they're corrupt, even when they kill us, and also the idea that they can kill us and just pay a fine. No, we should demand as policy that if a drug company knowingly provides a drug that kills people, they should lose their charter and the drug official should be held personally accountable. Right now, there's nothing that happens to them. So if they can make $12 billion, kill 60,000 people, true story, Vioxx, they killed 60,000 people minimum. They paid about $5 billion, but they did $22 billion in sales. Then it's a good business model for them, but it shouldn't be. Let's start taking away charters of any corporation and hold the people personally accountable if they engage in malice aforethought. Then watch how quickly all this drug business, vaccine business stops. And we should also have a national movement to get our Congress to vote back into law that if you give us a bad vaccine, you can be sued. And watch how quickly all vaccines disappear, or at least the only ones they put out are ones that can be proven to be safe or effective. That they haven't done yet. And to follow up on my other point, I'm going to spend more time this week explaining what a good education in an inner city would be. But you got to get the teachers, qualified teachers, back in those schools. And those that are there, you've got to give them more control over the curriculum and how it's taught. And you've got to get the community involved in bringing an environment that is healthy and safe for the child to learn in and for the teacher to want to be in. Otherwise, you have a positive loop, feedback loop, which doesn't mean positive outcome. It means the more crime, the more violence, the more gangs, the more teachers want to flee that environment, the worst outcome is going to be for the student. And why shouldn't we have counselors, good counselors, after you graduate from an inner school, take a look at what you've learned and then see what kind of school you should go to next instead of assuming, I was number one in this school, I should go to Harvard. Because there's almost a certainty for most people that you're going to drop out of the school, you're going to be in the lowest quantile there. Why not a school that matches your interest, your educational status, and then you can go and keep learning, keep growing. And then if the day comes when you feel, I can make it at Harvard, then make that choice. Our current system doesn't work, hasn't worked, and we've got to take the politics out of this and the ideologies and say we need to change it. Now, I'm also going to give one last thing here. I want to mention that this coming Saturday, and for the next four Saturdays, the only time in the next 12 months I'll be doing a health support group. And ideally, I like to see people over a period of time, but I've come up with a protocol that I believe can work in 30 days. We'll see. For people with arthritis, diabetes, and who are overweight, I believe that with a major lifestyle change that we can do a great deal of good for our health, lessen our chances of exacerbating disease or dying. And so if you'd like to be a part of it, you have to have one of those three conditions. You can call and there's room for three more. That's it. I'm choosing, our last group was 500 people. This time I want to keep it much lower because I'm the only one there and I'm going to be working myself every week from 3 to 5. So we got room for three more people. Call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422 if you'd like to join. And it starts this coming Saturday. Now I got an idea for you. This is just an idea. When only 1 million Americans vote for clearly the most qualified, most interested, most populist, most uncorruptible of all the candidates, then something's wrong with the system and the people. And so here is an alternative, something for us to think about. I've come up with what I consider what we should be working on for the next election campaign. It's young people, meaning here is an ideal cabinet backed by wise men and women who are older who would be there to fill in all the knowledge and life experience to see that things are done right. And these are really the best of the best. So who would I suggest? Here's some people for president, vice president. Representative Tulsi Gabbard, she's 36. She resigned from the Democratic National Group in protest. She was a Sanders supporter, but I believe Sanders sold out his group, and I will prove that later this week. But look how many young people went to Sanders. But then after Sanders left, he didn't file a lawsuit and challenge the illegitimacy of Hillary Clinton's nomination. And a lot of the people, over half of the millennials who backed him, would not back her. So you've got millions. You've got at least 10 to 20 million young people who would back someone who was young in their age group. You've got Kashma Sawant, who is 42, a socialist on Seattle City Council, very progressive, part of the Occupy movement, environmentalist, and leading in the state as the most progressive state in the nation right now. Abby Martin. I have a lot of respect for Abby. I think Abby would make a great leader in the White House, president or vice president. She's an absolutely outstanding investigative reporter, very smart, and knows she's up on any issue. She could dance circles around Clinton, Trump, Obama. They're not even in her league intellectually. You've got Zephyr Teachout, 46, law professor at Fordham University, very progressive. And those are some. Now, for the Department of Defense, who would help these people in the White House? Young people. Here's the Council of Wise Men and Women. Ray McGovern. This is the Department of Defense. Imagine having a Department of Defense run by Ray McGovern, Nick Terse, Jeremy Scahill, and one of them would be Secretary of Defense, the others be special advisors, and Andrew Bacevich. In the State Department, my recommendation would be Chris Hedges, but you also have Chris Murray, former senator. He's 43, who was the youngest member of the Senate at 39, very progressive on all the important issues, and very wise on foreign affairs on the Southeast, Middle East. Treasury Department, Michael Hudson, Professor Michael Hudson, Elizabeth Warren, David Corton, Naomi Prinz, Paul Craig Roberts, William Black, Attorney General, Danny Sheehan, Michelle Alexander, John Whitehead, Francis Boyle, Glenn Greenwald. These are all constitutional lawyers and very knowledgeable. And we would never have white-collar crime get away with anything, and we would stop all racial profiling. So think of this. Just think of the concept. Young people running the country, smart, progressive, and a proof by their actions and attitudes that they are committed to changing society for everyone, and backed up by a wise group of men and women. Department of Agriculture, David Bonner, 38 years old, and or Alex Baden, mayor, Ronnie Cummings, David Montgomery, Jeffrey Smith at the FDA, Mary Holland, Jonathan E. Mord, Gretchen Dubow, Diane Miller, Health and Human Services, Dr. Thomas Campbell, Colin Campbell's son. He's in his early 40s. Jill Stein would be great, not as president, but to run the Health and Human Services. There'd be no more corruption. Dr. Neil Barnard, Scott Tipps, Dr. Richard Davidson, professor of neurosurgery, University of Wisconsin, really bright. Peter Bregan. At the CIA and the National Institutes of, we have Edward Snowden. That would be my recommendation, believe it or not. Ray McGovern, Colleen Rowley, Melvin Goodman, Marjorie Cohen, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, Rocky Anderson, Department of Commerce, Loris Lessig, Ellen Brown, Dean Baker, Barbara Ehrenreich, the Department of Education, Carol Burris, she's in her mid-40s, and Diane Ravitch, Henry Giroux, Cornell West, Linda Darling-Hammond, Department of Interior, Tim DeChristopher, he's 35 years old, environmentalist, ecologist, and founder of the Peaceful Uprising, Derek Jensen, Brent Blackwelder, former president of Friends of the Earth, Dr. Sylvia Earle, ocean expert, Department of Housing, you got Glenn Ford, Peter Timmon, Gerald Friedman, Sasha Abrinsky, 45 years old, Oxford-trained sociologist in poverty issues. Who better to have as head of, instead of the moron we have there now, head of housing? Department of Labor, We have, I have several here that I would recommend, including Rabbi Michael Lerner, Ralph Nader, Robert Reich, EPA, Annie Leonard, 49 years old, current U.S. Director of Greenpeace, Winoni Halder, Harvey Wasserman, Richard Heimberg, UN Ambassador, Max Blumenthal, I think he's 39, Lawrence Lessig, Jerry Mander, and Jeffrey Sachs. In the Department of Climate, I would have a new Department of Climate with Professor Tim Garrett in his early 40s, Professor of Climate Change and Economics, University of Utah, Henry Pollack, Michael Mann, Natasha Sarkova, and James Hansen. And also a new department I would call the Department of Peace, and Dennis Kucinich, Cornel West, Media Benjamin, Harvey Wasserman, Marianne Williamson, Rabbi Michael Lerner, and a new department, Department of Interfaith and Religious Reconciliation, so we could go around the world and apologize and make amends and close down on military bases. Jim Garrison, Cornel West, Karen Armstrong, Harvey Cox, Andrew Harvey, and Robert Thurman. So you see, going the way we have, we're not going to get a better outcome the next time around. Change everything. Is it doable? You bet. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. And now, for those of you, whether you are an atheist, an agnostic, or whether you're a believer in higher spiritual principles, or an interfaith person, I thought you'd enjoy this music.
Every break. It's who I got.